Welcome to the Canteen Podcast, a show for anyone who has feelings about food. Join host Ali Houston as guests open up about their relationship with food and their thoughts on nutrition. Nourish yourself with the Canteen Podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of the Canteen Podcast. I'm your host Ali Houston. Our guest today is Dr. Sylvia Karpagam, who is an Indian public health doctor. It's a very revealing episode where we discuss the causes of widespread malnutrition in India, including withholding of nutritious animal foods, and the role that caste and religion play in influencing traditional eating and public policy. Also, how until recently, love of animals hasn't figured at all in this behaviour. And also, how eating beef has resulted in lynching and even murder. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit the subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. This podcast is made possible thanks to paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company. Paleocanteen.co.uk is the UK's one-stop paleo and low-carb food provider, where you can get restaurant-quality meals, grass-fed Scottish beef and lamb, outdoor bred pork, and a selection of paleo and low-carb products delivered chilled to your door. That's paleocanteen.co.uk. Use the code CANTEEN15, that's CANTEEN15, to get 15% off your first order. Thanks, and enjoy the show. Okay, and we're recording. And I'm lucky enough to have with me today Dr. Sylvia Karpagam. Am I saying that correctly?
Yes.
Who is an Indian public health doctor, writer, illustrator, and researcher. And she has an inter-religion, inter-caste, and inter-language background. So I'm really looking forward to talking to you. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Ali. Thank you so much for having me on the show. And I think I was quite inspired by the last show that you had with Dr. Asim. So I thought it's really important that more and more people speak out because there is quite a lot at stake. So thank you for doing this.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I suppose what you're talking about is the headline would be vegetarianism in India. And I first saw you online with an excellent article on vegetarianism in India, which really stunned me. Partly because of the shocking statistics around malnutrition that you talked about, and partly because I'd never seen an Indian person speak out against vegetarianism. And you're talking about the episode of the podcast that I did with Dr. Asim Malhotra.
Yeah, he did mention it there as well. He mentioned it.
Yes, that's right. And so maybe you could start by just saying, what's the situation with vegetarianism in India?
First of all, I think it's a myth that India is a vegetarian country. There is enough data, there's enough published data and scientific research evidence that many Indians are actually meat eaters. And even those who give information, like we do have large-scale surveys in India, and those who give out the information, some of them don't disclose that they are vegetarian. So if you factor that in as well, there's a paper published by a researcher called Balmurli Natarajan. If you can, you know, get to speak to him also, it would be really interesting. Where they say that factoring those who may not have disclosed that they are meat eaters, you have almost 80% of India that is meat eating. It's and that includes eggs and, you know, all the other, like poultry and all the other meats. So we do have a majority who are meat eaters. So it's a myth, first of all, that India is a vegetarian country. But if you look at the politics around it, and if you look at the way caste and I wouldn't even say religion, because even a lot of people from the majority religion, that is Hinduism in India, do eat eggs, do eat poultry, do eat other meats. And it's a caste thing. You have a dominant caste group who are, you know, who choose to be vegetarian for whatever religious reasons. It includes, you know, there are some groups like the Lingayats and the Jains who are vegetarian. And but the way the caste system operates is the majority of people who are in power, who are making decisions, who are representing India, who migrate outside and who speak on behalf of India, are the same caste group. So it's almost like the group that is in power decides and dictates what India is projected as. So I think it's important to understand that. Like a lot of times the outside world kind of buys into this, and they say that, you know, India is a vegetarian country. There was a recent conference also, there was an Eat Lancet conference where this person, I think he was Brent Loken, he's some scientist with the Eat Lancet group, and he said India can lead the way for, you know, plant-based foods. So a lot of people are not just buying into this myth, they're actually feeding off this whole myth that India is vegetarian.
I mean, for people, including myself, who don't really understand the caste system, how is it different from, how does it differ from religion? You know, do the castes intersect religion? And how many castes are there? And what does it mean to be part of a caste that's vegetarian? And are some of the castes purely vegetarian, or is it a mixture there too?
So, if you look at the caste system, it's a kind of a hierarchical system, and you have the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, the Vaishyas, and then the Shudras, and all of them fall within the caste system. So, but even among them, the Brahmins are considered as, you know, superior, and the grade of, you know, as you go down the ladder, so to speak, your status kind of comes down in the caste hierarchy. But then you also have a large group that falls outside this whole caste system, who are called the, you know, scheduled castes, or, you know, they were called the untouchables, or who identify as Dalits. So they don't even fall within the caste system. And over time, a lot of people have converted to other religions in India. So you have people converting to Islam or Christianity. So you do get a cross-section of different caste groups, but you do get a lot of the Dalits who have converted to, say, Islam and Christianity. And in India, a lot of this hierarchy is also transferred to the religion of conversion. So definitely, there are practices of casteism within the, you know, Christian community and within the Muslim community. So I would say that caste kind of cross-cuts across religions in India.
Okay. And I mean, would I be right in thinking that some of the Dalit or scheduled caste people, you said that maybe more of them have converted to other religions than Hinduism? I mean, I can understand why, if they were called untouchables, why they might not feel wanted.
Yeah, I think to some extent, I don't know a lot about what's happening or has happened in Islam, so I wouldn't like to you know, comment on that. But definitely, with Christianity, conversion has brought some amount of dignity and. In terms of access to education itself, I think a lot of first generation and second generation people who have converted to Christianity have had access to good quality education, because I think the mission schools have played quite an important role in providing education and also access to English. So I think having access to English is, in a way, has opened up the doors for, you know, the Dalit community to be able to access jobs. Apart from that, the government has a system of reservation where, you know, in government jobs, it's like affirmative action, where in government jobs, people, there is a percentage of, you know, the jobs reserved for people from Dalit communities, but it's not available if you convert it. So a Dalit Christian or a Dalit Muslim would not be able to access these government benefits.
Interesting. Okay, well, let's park the caste system for a moment, and maybe you could outline the picture of malnutrition in India. What's the situation?
It's so the way we see malnutrition is you have undernutrition. You also have obesity. So obesity is like becoming a growing problem in India. But the major part of our nutrition problem is still undernutrition. And undernutrition is basically that children are not gaining weights as they expected to for their age. And you also have stunting, which is children are not reaching the heights that they expected to reach for a certain age. And this is almost 38 to 40% in India. That means in children who are say 0 to 6 years. That means under 6 years, most children, like 38 to 40% of children, have not reached their expected heights and expected weights. So it's quite a huge problem, and this is particularly more even in the scheduled caste, the scheduled tribe, Muslim communities.
Wow, that's a huge issue. I mean, I think sometimes when we talk about nutrition, and sometimes at the extremes, you're talking about small communities, but India has roughly a billion people, right? So the scheduled caste...
In terms of absolute numbers, it's a huge problem.
It's a huge problem. It's a sizable slice of humanity.
And that is in children, but if you look at adults, there's also something called the chronic energy deficiency, where people still are not getting enough nutrition to perform. Like you need energy to maintain your weight, but you also need energy to perform your, you know, day-to-day activities and to do work. So a lot of them, like almost 30% women, have a chronic energy deficiency. So because they're not able to compromise on the work that they do and the basic functions of their body, they compromise on their weights. So you will see a lot of people who are very thin, very emaciated, because they just haven't got enough food to eat.
And besides chronic energy deficiency and stunting in children, you've spoken about anemia before as well, and that's a big problem in India, right?
So apart from that, you also have multiple micronutrient deficiencies. You have people who are anemic, you have people who are deficient in zinc and you know, vitamin A. But the problem is when you start looking at these as like isolated deficiencies, then people start looking for very non-sustainable solutions. So for example, if you said someone has anemia, the government responds by saying that we'll give you iron tablets, but just iron tablets may not be enough. It's not like the body takes iron and it's just iron that's being converted into, you know, hemoglobin. It's a whole process that is required to convert iron to hemoglobin, and for it to be functional, you need like a good quality proteins, you need zinc, you need vitamins, you need a whole set of nutrients for the body to function adequately. And just minimizing it by saying this is, you know, this deficiency or that deficiency is a problem, then the solution becomes to just replace that. And the way the government or corporates try to replace it is by, you know, fortifying foods, or they say they package foods or they process foods, and they say with added vitamins and with added minerals and, you know, added iron. Now, Britannia is quite a big company in India. They're saying we will give iron fortified biscuits to children because they say anemia is a problem. But one can see why that cannot be a solution. It's problematic on multiple fronts.
Yeah, children aren't anemic because they have a biscuit deficiency, right?
Yeah, true. And look at what it does to the eating habits of children. What are you teaching children? What are you doing about the culture of eating, the tradition of eating, the memory or the cultural memory of what people are used to? All those things play quite an important role. And once you reduce it to a nutrient, then your solutions also become very nutrient specific, and it becomes it really opens the door for markets. All of these are very market friendly solutions. Beyond that, they're not solutions. They're not long term solutions.
Sure, that's a good point, I think, because when you can create a shelf stable, cheaply produced product that has the backing of public health officials, that you can sell at a really good markup, then probably almost across the board, those types of products are unlikely to be nutritious.
Yeah, in fact, they say that once you fortify, you bring in a shelf life. But sometimes a lot of foods may not have a shelf life, but then fortification brings in a shelf life. It changes the taste. It increases the cost. And in India, if you see, a lot of food is locally produced. Like, for example, you grow some wheat, you take it to your local the grinders, they'll grind it for you, they'll powder it for you, and you'll take it back, and you know, you lose it at your own home. But once you bring in this idea of labeling and packaging and fortification, it'll become almost mandatory. It'll become illegal for people to, you know, just do things locally. They will have to send their grains to a company which will then process it and, you know, fortify it and label it for you and then package it and then market it back to you at much bigger cost than what you actually need to spend. And we're actually seeing that with a lot of the grains that people used to keep aside for their own consumption. It's now not becoming available to the people, you know, in their own communities.
Hmm. So there's this problem with malnutrition. What do you think can be done?
What can be done about malnutrition?
Well, I mean, is some malnutrition simply down to poverty, or is the specific type of food more important? What do you think?
So if you look at guidelines brought by, so we have the National Institute of Nutrition in India, which is a research body, and it also gives a lot of recommendations on nutrition. If you look at the research clearly shows that the solution is already available. If you're looking at the requirements, say for a child or a pregnant woman, then the kind of foods that have to be given to address malnutrition and also to address micronutrient deficiencies, it does include a large. It does include animal foods, it includes eggs, it includes milk and milk products. But once these are out as recommendations, or the way these recommendations are interpreted, that's where the vegetarian or the caste bias comes in. It's actually a prejudice, where the interpretation is India is predominantly vegetarian, and therefore people can't afford these animal foods, and therefore they can eat these vegetables. they can eat green leafy vegetables. Or Indians can't anyway don't eat meat, they anyway can't afford it. It's expensive, animal foods are expensive. And instead of saying make animal foods more accessible and more available and more affordable to people, what you're saying is you can't eat it, so, you know, we are not going to recommend it. And then it becomes very cereal based, very cereal heavy. And the government actually has a lot of schemes, like nutrition schemes for the country. Most of them are very cereal dependent. Like you have rice and you have wheat and you have millets. But beyond that, there's very little that food that is subsidized for people. And the question is always asked, then why are vegetarians healthy? If you look at secular trends on height, the vegetarians have been showing a steady increase in height. And so then the question is, how can they maintain, you know, a steady increase in height? And that's because they do have access to a lot of animal foods like milk and milk products. So they have a lot of paneer and a lot of curd and, you know, ghee and butter. But these, they don't call it animal source food. They say it's still vegetarian.
And so that's the parts of the castes that stay vegetarian who have more money. That's the more.
Yeah, it's socially, yeah, they have much better jobs. They have much better incomes. And these foods like milk and milk-based products are quite expensive. And the kind of vegetarianism that is being promoted for the poor is devoid of all of these sources of nutrition. If you look at the way the calculations happen of, you know, income, minimum income or poverty line, it doesn't factor in all of these. They don't say a family should be able to afford, say, meat and chicken and eggs and milk, you know, at this quantity for, you know, so many days in a week, and then fix a minimum wage. They remove all of these and fix the minimum wage. So people cannot afford a lot of these, you know, the foods, the animal sources that the rich vegetarians can afford.
Mm-hmm. And so this is where the role of caste really comes into it in a big way, because it's clearly not just about poverty when you've got a disproportionate number of poorer people in these castes that are succumbing to the malnutrition, chronic energy deficiency, anemia problems. And so that means that there's something going on in the home and in public where the caste hierarchy is being imposed. So how does that actually happen in public and in private? And do you think it differs in public and in private?
I don't know if there's a difference in public and private, but I can give you a few examples of how this, you know, operates. So firstly, it's made out to be a religious thing. So there is, instead of saying it's a one caste group that is vegetarian, then a narrative is that most Hindus don't eat meat. Most Hindus are vegetarian, which is not true. And if you look at the religion, that's how there is a kind of criminalization of communities that eat, you know, like beef, for instance, the Muslims and the Christians and the Dalits who are, you know, who consume beef. There is what do you say? These foods are considered as inferior. Mm-hmm. They're considered as somehow catering to your baser, you know, instincts. And because the food is inferior, then the people who eat them are also inferior. So it kind of reinforces this whole idea of purity and pollution, and that the vegetarians are pure and clean and, you know, the touchable, and the meat eaters, the beef eaters are, you know, impure and polluted and untouchable. And I think so there is a lot of shame around eating foods that people are traditionally used to eating in their homes, and we've seen that operating, like we parents say that our children eat beef or meat at home, and once they take it to school, and schools, there is a whole system that operates to make the child feel that this is not good, it's dirty, whatever you're eating, the child is made fun of. And within a few weeks of doing that, the child itself says, I don't want to take this food. The child itself says, I don't want to take meat from home to the schools. And this puts a lot of, pressure on the parents, because the children also bring those learnings back home. And they say that they try to kind of encourage their families not to eat this food. And the other thing that we're seeing is that meat eating is kind of linked to intelligence. So children are told that if you want to study well, and if you want to do well, and if you want to become a meritorious student, then give up eating meat and become vegetarian. So children have said that if we eat meat, our bodies grow, and if we eat vegetables, then our brains grow. So this is, and if you look at the kind of caste and class profile of the teachers and principals, most of them come from these same communities, because the kind of social capital, they've already accessed education, they've already accessed resources, and they're the critical mass in all of these spaces.
Interesting. And I suppose that's a really powerful location for legitimizing information. You know, if it's systemic in the school system, then it's almost taken to be fact. And I guess there's more extreme examples that you hear about where people are physically hurt or killed, and it's to do with meat eating. I mean, how does that come about, and where does that come about?
So, first of all, beef has been banned in many states in India, the slaughter of beef, and the atmosphere has been created where they say that you shouldn't be eating beef for whatever reasons. And then it becomes a way of targeting certain communities. So there have been a lot of lynchings in the last 2 years, 3 years in India, where people, they don't even have to possess beef. It's even the suspicion of possessing beef. So like people who they've had crowds swarming into their houses and saying, you have meat in your house, you have beef in your house, and they've been lynched. And the whole system operates to collude with that and say, he was, you know, that he had beef, so it's okay for him to be lynched.
And by lynch, you know, do you mean like in the American sense, where they're hanged?
No. A mob of people just surround, one man or two or three men, basically beat them to death. It's quite a few such instances, and these are filmed and shared with other people. It's basically to create an identity that this person has killed a cow and eaten a cow, and he needs to be punished. And so you have mobs which decide that this person has to be punished. It's another matter that India exports a large amount of beef to other countries.
I didn't know that.
A lot of income for India comes through this export of beef to other countries. So yeah, that's the kind of double standards that's operating.
I've read you pick up on, and you've said it earlier, about purity, impurity, you know, cleanliness, uncleanliness. And I suppose the kind of more Indian sattvic, tamasic sort of a dichotomy. And that you've said before that it's really what's going on with vegetarianism in India is an agenda about maintaining a hierarchical status quo. So it's about control and it's about humiliating the meat eater into this self-imposed state of inferiority. And that nowhere does a love of animals figure in this behavior. You know, do you see anywhere where it's a compassionate thing that's going on?
So, I mean, I wouldn't be able to comment on that because if it's now being made into a love of animals, so I really wouldn't, you know, be able to say no. It's not a love of animals, but like just 2 days back, there's this article in one of our, you know, mainstream media. It was a Hindu, and it was this lady who claims to be a lawyer, an environmentalist, and an animal lover and of cattle ranching. And then she talks about meat eating, and she talks about antibiotics, and then she says, if you really love animals, then you shouldn't be, you know, eating animals. So I see that it's partly being used in a way, but sometimes the motives become important, the real reasons, or the intent becomes important. And it's very hard to argue with someone who says, you know, I feel sorry for the animal. That's why I don't want you to eat it. But then you're also killing people, and you're also abusing people, and also harassing people in the name of, you know, love or concern for an animal. So it's, you know, sometimes it just doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's impossible to truly know what someone's intent is. And I guess you have to go on good faith and not second guess people and just take their word for it. But like you hinted at there, the issue really is when you tell someone that you're doing something for your own reasons, then if you're not hurting anyone, then whose business is it? But if you tell someone that you should be doing something because of their reasons, then that's a different matter. And that's what's going on here. It's coercion, which seems to be causing malnutrition, and it's for the reasons of the people who are not malnourished. And that's your main problem with it, isn't it?
It is, yes. If you look at the midday meal scheme, that is a scheme that has been mandated by you know, under the National Food Security Act. So it's a legal right of the child to have a midday meal. And it's for children between 6 to 14 years. Basically, there are a whole set of guidelines where the child is a government school or even a government-supported school should provide the child with a hot-cooked meal prepared at the school and with around 450 to 700 calories and about 12 to 20 grams of protein. So that like almost meets one third of the child's needs. And eggs play a very important role here because eggs, a 60 gram egg gives almost 8 grams of protein. It's highly nutritious. It's the bioavailability of proteins is very high, so much so it's considered as a reference protein. And culturally, if you look at the
Before you go on there about the midday meals, can I just pick up on that point about a reference protein? So it's so bioavailable protein from eggs that it's called a reference protein. Now, this point gets debated a lot about quality of protein. What would be a couple of examples of proteins that wouldn't qualify as reference proteins?
So the protein from cereal, from soya bean, from pulses, they wouldn't qualify as reference proteins. Breast milk and eggs are the only ones that have very high bioavailability, almost close to 100%.
So how about meat?
Meat is about 78%, I think.
Interesting. And the pulses and so on would be about the same as that, or lower, or?
I wouldn't be able to give you the exact numbers, so I can refer and get back to you on this.
Yeah, that'd be good. We could link something.
Yeah, definitely lower.
Yeah, sorry. So you were saying that you've got this high quality egg protein as an option, but maybe that's not what's happening in the midday meal.
Yeah, so in many states, the eggs are not being given. And when we approach our own government and ask them, why are you not giving eggs to children? The reason they gave is that it's for religious reasons. So the thing is that most of the children who access government schools eat eggs. Almost 98% of them eat eggs. They like eggs. And they're being denied that. So the whole idea of a scientific meal, a nutritious meal, is being derailed for non-scientific reasons.
So is there any pretense from people who are making these decisions that it's about nutrition?
So they say that for instance, the midday meal scheme has been contracted out by the government to another organization, and that organization refuses to use onions or garlic or provide eggs in the meal. And the reason, they don't eat eggs, they don't promote eggs, but they also think onions and garlic are they're tamasic. They increase lust in the children and they reduce concentration in the children. Now the government has a prescribed menu, and this organization is violating the prescribed menu, but is still able to get away with it. So so who do you blame? Like, it's of course the government is the primary responsible, and the government has to factor in these things. But clearly, the nutritional needs of the child are not the priority of the government.
It's really interesting that you talk about the tamasic side of things. So it's like sattvic tamasic is the kind of it's Ayurvedic medical terms, is that right? Or kind of spiritual terms, so that sattvic food would be, or sattvic people would be calm, kind, and the foods that go along with them, which don't necessarily have a basis in scientific reality, would be things like vegetables and nuts and so on. And the tamasic foods, like you said, inflame lust and are paradoxically as well seemingly lazy people. And it would be things like meat and fish and
eggs are considered to be the menstrual discharge of the hen.
Right. So you've got these, you've got this sort of heavenly, devilish kind of dichotomy. And it's similar in a way to the Seventh-day Adventists whose teachings informed the formation of Kellogg's, who wanted to make a grain-based food to dampen down the libido of a devilish youth, and or a devilish populace. And it sounds very similar. It's really interesting how these things seem to spring up in multiple places. I mean, do you think that vegetarianism in the West bears a resemblance to vegetarianism in India?
One point I want to make about the, I mean, the to add to the previous point, the Indian institutions itself have showed that onion and garlic improve the bioavailability of or bioabsorption of iron and zinc. So we've talked about how deficiency of iron and zinc is quite a problem in India, and these are one of the few vegetarian foods which actually increase the absorption of iron and zinc, and they're being called as tamasic and being denied to children who are malnourished and who are culturally used to eating these foods. So yeah, coming back to your other point, I've only recently been become aware of this whole issue that's happening around veganism in the West. And the Eat Lancet group recently had a conference here in India, and that's definitely a cause for concern, because they to come to a country where there's so much malnutrition, so much anemia, so much of vitamin A deficiency, to come here and say that you are a model for plant-based food, that's what this person from Eat Lancet said. He said India is a model for plant-based foods, and this veganism should be promoted among the adolescents. So you're talking about some kind of an indoctrination, and you're talking about it in a country where there's so much of caste-based issues around food, and so much of malnutrition and so much of anemia. So it seems not just uninformed, but it seems very unethical to talk in a country like India about veganism. But it seems to be there are many groups of people who are promoting it. So you have the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition, which is a conglomeration of corporates like Danone and Nestle and Coca-Cola and all the
vegan health foods.
Yeah, so they are collaborating with the Food Safety Standards Authority of India and Eat Lancet. Now, FSSAI is going in for fortification a big way. They want to fortify rice, and they want to fortify wheat and oils and milk. So it's I don't think there are clear boundaries in terms of countries. So I think what decisions are made in some countries do affect countries like India. And to talk about asking Indians to consume less meat or to reduce their meat consumption because of concerns with the climate, I think it's really ironic, because here people hardly eat, it's even though they would like to eat. Like if you go to a chicken shop, say in India, you'd see there is a hierarchy in what people buy. Also, the well-off people might buy the boneless chicken or the breast piece or the thigh or the leg. And as you go down further down the economic scale, there are people buying the neck or the wings or spare parts, and they just spend like very little money. They'll say, just give me a few grams of spare parts because they want to make a meal for their children. And the quantity eaten is very little, and the environmental concerns are quite huge in India. But to attribute all of that to meat eating, I think, again, it's very unethical to do that. So if you look at just today, there was an article published by the All India Institute of Medical Sciences where they said heavy metals and toxins contaminate our food. A lot of the issues that people are facing, health issues, can be attributed to heavy metal poisoning. And if you see the kind of pollution control, the control of industrial waste, it's very poor, it's very poorly regulated. A lot of untreated industrial waste is actually going into our water. It's contaminating our groundwater. And that's untreated water is being used to water crops. So all these issues are, you know, just pushed aside, and you just pretend that that's not contributing to, you know, the health problems, and you just say meat is your problem in your country, and you know you should go vegan. It's very problematic that these kind of discussions are even happening.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting that you point out that it's not so much a national border barrier, it's more of a corporate domain. And I've just been watching the documentary The Century of Self, and it's about the work that Edward Bernays did, the nephew of Sigmund Freud, and he really invented public relations and took the sort of mass psychology of corporate advertising strategy to a whole new level. You know, managed to convince women to smoke, and with this brilliant ad campaign. And really, I think that's evolved a lot in the last 100 years. And we've got to the stage now where it's really difficult to know who to trust, because you don't know where that information is coming from, whether it's a legitimate individual who's acting on their own intelligence, or whether it's someone who's being paid to say things that back up what Coca-Cola and Nestle and so on want them to say. And it's only rational. If I was an executive at a corporation, that's what I would be doing. Because it works.
Exactly. And I was just thinking today, some of them have such, like, they legitimize themselves by, you know, calling themselves foundations or charities. And like, you have this Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition, and you know, you have a lot of these, the groups, the face they present to the public. And there's no guidelines on stating conflict of interest upfront. Like, what are you affiliated to? Who are you affiliated to? Who's going to profit? Which markets are you connected to? Which corporates, which companies? There's nothing out, you know, in the open. And it's very hard to expect even doctors or, you know, public health people or civil society to be able to keep snooping around. And the minute someone catches on to some of these things, then they change their name. So there are actually no, you know, global guidelines for these kind of ethics, and it's being abused. It's they just project themselves as a very, you know, charitable front. And if you see, like, a lot of government offices, these groups have so much access. Like, we want a meeting, you know, as citizens, you want a meeting with the government, and it's so difficult to access these kind of government, you know, decision-making processes. But all these companies, we've seen that with health, and we've seen that with, you know, the food industry also. They just have an open-door policy for these kind of. And I also think the government itself sometimes may not be informed. They just fall for all this, you know, the scale of these groups and the way they promote themselves, make the market themselves. I don't think even governments are prepared or understand, like, what's happening. And we saw that, like, with spirulina is a product that some companies were trying to give to malnourished children. These children weren't even eating food. They weren't even being given food, you know, in the Anganwadis, you know, that's integrated child development scheme for children who are less than 6 years. They were being given these spirulina capsules by companies. And these were malnourished children. There's absolutely no research, you know, what is the effect of this? Where has it been grown? What is the quality control? The government said, you know, they're giving it free of cost, and they said it helps malnutrition. So, you know, we just okay with it. So I think that is a big part of the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Where do you think is the greatest hope for public discussion of nutrition?
The greatest hope?
Yeah, if there's so many bad things at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, as far as I see, there's a lot of community knowledge and there's a lot of traditional knowledge. There's also a lot of research. At least in India, like, one can't fault the research that's available. And the kind of knowledge that's available with the communities, it's just that between these, there's a problem. Like, there's the research is not reaching the community, and the community needs are not being factored into policy. So I think if there's more of sharing of actual research on, you know, good foods with people, people will make the right choices. And many times it reinforces what they're already doing. Like, we've heard loads of mothers saying that, like, even my own dad was talking about his mom. She had to raise her, you know, 8 children, and they weren't very well off. And she used to make dried fish for them. Dried fish is not very expensive. And it's very flavorful. Some people like the flavor and some people don't like it. But it kind of enhances the flavor of the food. So you just add a little of it. Children eat much more quantities. So to say that is, you know, it's impure and it's polluted and, you know, it's unhealthy, it's bad for the environment. It puts a lot of burden on the communities. And in fact, it erases even the kind of cultural memory that people have of good eating practices.
Yeah, that's obviously an issue, because that can disappear within a generation.
Yeah. And I think encouraging local foods, like, if the government can, you know, give loans to people to grow their own poultry, to grow their own eggs, that supply the local schools and the local Anganwadis, feed the local communities. It's kind of environmentally also very viable. It's very sustainable and it's very nutritious. It takes away the dependence on, say, a company or a corporate. But then everything in the system is working to do exactly the opposite. You're doing everything to take away people's self-reliance, and making them more and more dependent on, you know, very centralized, a very homogeneous corporate kind of, you know, food system.
Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes I hear people talk about how you mustn't blame this on companies, and I hear what they're saying, which I think is something like, companies are not to blame for doing what companies are designed to do. And I sort of get that argument. But on the other hand, you know, I think that'll ultimately be their undoing, because companies that do stuff really well that don't hurt people, like, I don't know, sports equipment manufacturers or airplane manufacturers, you know, where them making things which people enjoy and are good for their health, ultimately, don't kill them, will drive profits. I think in the longer term, if vegetarianism is adopted even more widely, and I don't think at the moment in the UK it's that popular. I think the voices are a lot louder than the numbers are large. But okay. I think, you know, 85% or so of vegetarians and vegans come away from it within a couple of years. And I think the more people who try it, the more people realize that it actually can cause pretty severe health problems. And that to me is a hope. I would rather that people didn't have to go through that, of course, but I think inevitably that's what's going to happen. And no matter how much people are told that it wasn't the food they were eating, because vegetarianism or veganism can't be unhealthy, that they're not going to, they're going to trust their own instincts in the end.
I don't know if I would agree or be that hopeful in the sense, if you look at what's happening with sugar and say, for example, diabetes and refined foods, it's, a person has been diagnosed with diabetes. There's no system that's in place to tell them, you know, these are your choices. You're, on the one hand, you're giving people access to a lot of these, you know, sugars and, you know, unrefined or refined carbohydrates. And you're not telling them that, you know, the solution to your problem is, you know, to give up these and to, you know, have more of natural or animal-based foods. And in India, we're seeing that a lot of that, and I think it's happening in the West also, where because of all the ill health due to malnutrition, it's becoming more and more medicalized. The solution is, you have this problem, therefore you take this medicine, or you take this vitamin, or you take this drop. And then how do you break that cycle? So I think putting information out to people is really important, which is like one of the reasons why I'm like doing this. It's I'm not great on, you know, audio or video, but I just thought it's at least it's important the message goes out. I've spoken to lots of people. I go to colleges or schools and I talk to civil society, and there's such a little understanding, you know, of how food and health is linked, how bad eating can affect your health. People just get trapped into that cycle of bad eating and then bad health. And either way, it's the, you know, the corporates and the pharma that's benefiting. So there are voices, but I don't think they're as loud. And they should get louder, I think, offering spaces. And I think that's why what you're doing is really important, because you're offering a space for people, you know, bring out a counter narrative and challenge some of these things that are almost becoming like mainstream beliefs.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess with veganism, you're right. It's not as big as they project it to be. And in fact, I was thinking that vegetarians wouldn't really adopt veganism because it means involving giving up dairy and dairy products. And definitely, I don't think vegetarians would give up on that.
Yeah, I think, well, I know a lot. I know a few vegetarians who are big cheese addicts, and fair enough. Yeah, and I agree with you that there's a huge place for trusted voices saying, giving out information, like doctors who have clinical experience. And those are the people who really get listened to, and rightly so. You know, there's a big place for people to teach themselves things, and I think that's right. But I think there are mechanisms that people without training don't necessarily know about, so that if someone was to give out detailed nutrition advice to someone without taking a personal history, then they could hurt them. And so I think doctors making scientifically based statements is a big part of the solution.
Yes.
And what do you eat?
What do I eat?
Yeah.
I eat everything, pretty much everything.
I visited India once and went in the north to Delhi and then up further north to Himachal Pradesh.
Okay.
In the Himalaya. And okay. It was beautiful up there. The food wasn't great on the trek, but everything was in a tin. So okay. It's to be expected. But I do love Indian food so much. What's your favorite couple of dishes?
I like biryani like all kinds of biryani. But yeah, it has to have meat in it. And my brother makes like some really good steaks, beef steaks and pork. Yeah, so just
a little bit of everything.
Sorry?
A little bit of everything.
Yeah, I mean, I just eat, whatever. I'm not a great connoisseur of food.
And do you think there's an ideal human diet? Do you think that exists?
Yeah, I think no processing, locally sourced, varied, as diverse as possible. Try to get as many nutrients as possible from as many foods as possible. And I mean, there are food groups, right? You have your, I think in India, definitely cutting down on the carbs would be a good idea, on the cereals. More of protein, more of animal protein, lots of milk, especially for children, because it's definitely associated with heights. And we need people to eat better. We need people to grow taller. We need people to have more energy to be able to, you know, put on weight and also to do, you know, activities. Which is lacking now.
Well, I really enjoyed talking to you, and I really appreciate you coming on to talk and tell the other side of the story from over there.
I really enjoyed being on the show. I'm sorry, I wasn't prepared for some of the questions, but maybe next time.
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, maybe in a while we can revisit stuff. Actually, I've had my old physics professor, Ken Strain, on before, and I've recorded an episode with Tucker Goodrich, who I don't know if you're aware of him. He's an American. He works on Wall Street in tech. But he's a kind of amateur researcher as well. And he's got a lot to say. They both have a lot to say about the role of vegetable oils in the health crises around the world. And although they're not big fans of grains or sugar, they really dislike vegetable oils. So they're both coming back on soon to do a special episode. So I definitely want to, you know, I think things change all the time in the world of food. So it'd be good to revisit India in a while when there's some new developments.
Yeah, definitely. And there are loads of other people you can talk to, so I could put you in touch with them.
That would be great.
Have different voices about the issues.
Yeah, definitely. So where can people find you if they want to read more about your stuff?
So I have a blog called Random Thoughts. And yeah, I'm also on Twitter at Saki339.
That's S-A-K-I-E 339.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll link it in the show notes and when I put the episode out. But I will sign off just now and say thanks again.
Okay, thank you, Ali. Thank you so much for having me on the show. And look forward to many more episodes from you.
Thanks, Sylvia. Thanks for listening, everyone. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit the subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. This podcast is made possible thanks to paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company. PaleoCanteen.co.uk is the UK's one-stop paleo and low-carb food provider, where you can get restaurant-quality meals, grass-fed Scottish beef and lamb, outdoor-bred pork, and a selection of paleo and low-carb products delivered chilled to your door. That's PaleoCanteen.co.uk. Use the code CANTEEN15, that's CANTEEN15, to get 15% off your first order. Thanks. See you next time.